And welcome to Minute 68 of Movie Around Minute, the daily podcast, where we take a wild trip to the 1987 John Hughes comedy, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Duncan Shields.
Poet. Hello!
What? Yeah, okay, there you go. Poet and a whole bunch of other things. You just want to talk. I know, I can hear it. I can hear it. You must be sitting in the hot seat. Are you in the hot seat?
I'm in the hot seat.
All right, so we have Duncan Shields with us, who is also the co-host of the Time Bandits Minute and the host of Chronologically Speaking, and an artist, a poet, an author, an animator, and so on and so forth, et cetera, et cetera. Sir Duncan, welcome.
Thank you. I am also a Canadian, much like John
Kennedy. There you go.
Which I did want to start, if I can, to talk about a little something about
John Candy. You want to wait until Friday when we're going to be doing your top five of John Candy, or you want to do it today?
Heck yes.
All right, that's a great idea. There you go. It's a teaser, so people have to come back to listen to Duncan's story about John Candy on Friday. Let's hope you actually make it to the end of the week. You know, because if not, we're all going to miss it. I'm going to miss it too. So hold that thought. Make an asterisk and mark that spot, and we'll get to it. We'll get to it in another 2 days. So Minute 68 begins with Dell having a complaint and ends with Neil making an offer. So yesterday, the smoldering farm and country, Detroit, what do we call it? A
Detroit farm and country town. Our Canyon Arrow.
That's what it is. You have the Gran Torino aspect in there.
What a bizarre Canyon Arrow. Detroit Grand.
It's not a real car. I actually discussed this a few weeks ago that there's I found debates online where people are discussing, you know, what different cars this car is an amalgam of.
Well, it says, 1986 Chrysler LeBaron Town and Country Convertible Grand Detroit Farm and Country Turbo.
There you go.
Come on. Oh, it might not be a LeBaron. Might not be a LeBaron. But,
no, it's based for a second, on a LeBaron.
They show the owner's manual in one
scene. They show the owner's manual, and we see just that it says 1987. That's all we see on it.
I see.
Yeah, we don't get to read inside of it.
Right.
So Dell yesterday started by or ended the minute by saying to Neil, you know, you could have killed me slugging me in the gut. And then he says he continues his little speech here. He says, you know, you could have killed me slugging me in the gut when I wasn't ready. That's how Houdini died, you know. Now, I know who Houdini is. I'm assuming you do, too. Do you know who Houdini was?
I do.
You do? All right. Well, I have a little bit of information about Houdini. So Harry Houdini, do you know what his real name was?
Oh, man. I did. I don't know. I forget. What was it?
His name was Eric Weiss.
Eric Weiss. Yeah. Okay, cool.
Born March 24th, 1874, and passed away on October 31st, 1926. So he was a Hungarian-American escape artist, illusionist, and stunt performer. Most people know him for the fact that he had all these different type of escape acts that he would use. His pseudonym of Houdini actually referenced his spiritual mentor, the French magician Robert Houdin, who died in 1871, which it's very interesting because he died 4 years before he was even born. Houdin died four years before Weiss was born. So I guess he was able to get information. He looked it up on Wikipedia, you know, when he was old enough, you know, back in the 1800s.
Yeah, back then.
Yeah.
Must have gone back to, like, I don't know, movie posters in the library or something.
They didn't even have movie posters back then.
Event posters.
Apparently.
Maybe he wrote an autobiography.
Who knows? That's interesting to wonder about. So he was mostly known for being able to get out of straitjackets, underwater, in milk cans. You know, they found all these different things that he could be able to get out of and stuff like that. He was also the president of the Society of American Magicians, and he would go around debunking other people's magic from fraudulent artists. people who were claiming to do that they're,
Oh.
and he also would sue anyone who would try to copy any of his stunts. He didn't sound like the nicest guy based on these type of things, but he was
Did
also an
you
actor. He
look
was
up
also an
pictures up?
actor. He was in
If you look,
no, he was in
sorry.
a number of movies, but since he didn't make enough money from them, he quit. And he also loved to fly. He was an aviator, and he wanted to become the first man to fly an aircraft to Australia. But I don't
Oh.
think he actually ma managed to do that. What was your question?
Did you see, have you seen pictures of Jean-Eugène Robert Houdin?
No.
He's a very imperious looking dude. So I can dig that he was someone not to be trifled with. And yeah, he was a magician and an illusionist and an inventor and an author, but he was also a
Ooh.
clockmaker. So that's this guy's, that's Houdini's inspiration here. So he was an author
Interesting.
and he had a little theater. He had a theater in Paris. He entertained the wealthy. He was a very much, yeah, he transformed magic from a pastime for the lower classes seen at fairs to an entertainment for the wealthy, which he offered in a theater opened in Paris. So, and that's preserved by the tradition of modern magician to
Wow.
perform in
Yeah.
tales, right? He's the fancy pants magician. That's kind of what he
Interesting.
originated.
Okay. So now,
Yeah.
basically, Dell mentioned the fact that that's how Houdini died. So Houdini, one of the things that he would go around telling people was is that he was able to make his stomach hard as steel, and anyone can punch him, and they won't be able to do any damage to him. Okay. So what happened was is that
Yeah.
he had hurt his foot, and he was lying on a couch, and two people came in and said they wanted to give him a little bit of a few punches to show that they can actually hurt him. And because he wasn't ready for it and wasn't able to prepare his stomach properly for it, so he basically had He got a ruptured appendix from it. He died of
Yeah.
peritonitis secondary to a ruptured appendix. Well, appendix. Now, what's even more amazing is that this happened. He died 3 days after this event happened. Okay, he was in Montreal, and that's where he got
Yeah.
punched. And then a few days later, he was in Detroit, my hometown, doing a show there. And he actually collapsed in the middle of the show because he had 104 fever, which and they took him to the hospital, and
Yikes.
it was too late, and he died from that. Now, what's very interesting is that they did a very large amount of research after he died because of all the insurance policies that he had, and they actually. Based on their
Sure.
findings, they actually paid double indemnity. Okay, now do you know what double indemnity is besides the movie with Fred
Oh,
McMurray?
yeah. I thought double indemnity. I always get it confused with double jeopardy.
Right, double jeopardy means that you can't be tried for the same crime twice. So double indemnity is a clause in life insurance or accident policies where the company agrees to pay the stated multiple, double, triple, whatever, of the face amount of the contract in cases of death caused by accident. This includes murder by a person other
Right.
than and not inclusion with the beneficiary of the insurance policy and most accidental deaths. It excludes suicide and deaths caused by the insured person's own gross negligence as well as natural causes. Okay. So, in the movie Double
Right.
Indemnity, the idea is that Fred McMurray is an insurance agent, and he pretends to change the clause of his girlfriend's husband's insurance policy so that they can kill him in an accidental way and then get double the amount of money.
Yeah.
That's what the movie's all about. Okay. In
Right.
2006,
Good movie, by the way. I know that Edward G. Robinson took the role off and didn't get paid very much for it, but he was really into not being cast as a
Yes,
villain
he was
again
actually great as the hero in that
because
movie where
his
he's
whole.
trying to, he's the insurance investigator trying to find out what really happened.
Because at that point he was already being widely caricatured and meh, see, meh, and
Yes.
that whole stuff was already being sort of cast as mob boss after mob boss after mob boss because he was so good at it, but he leapt at the chance to play
Right.
this one, to play a bit of a heroic role for a change. He's such a good actor. I saw him in a good movie called The Night Has a Thousand Eyes, which also
Oh,
has
wow.
that song in it, where he plays a psychic, and it's about how troubling it is to be a psychic because he gets these flashes of the future that don't make sense until they're happening. And by then it's kind
Yeah,
of too
then he
late.
needs to figure it out.
Right? Yeah, so it's a really good,
Wow.
pretty good little movie. Anyway, this is
No,
not the
but it's
Edward G.
fine. It doesn't
Robinson movie,
matter.
but there you go.
I love going off on tangents. That's what we're here for, you know.
Yeah. He's got this, well, there's this one scene where he's like, it's said on the radio that there was an escaped lion. There was a broken pitcher lying on the floor. And somebody said, there are pterodactyls in the room. I don't know how any of this makes sense. And then they're all in a room later, and someone in the house has been killed. And somebody like, they hear glass crunching underfoot and they look down and there's been a pitcher was on the ground, but it was underneath a napkin. So the person didn't see it. So he accidentally stepped on it and broke the pitcher. And he's like, oh geez, that's the broken pitcher on the floor. And then they turn on the radio and there is a news article. There's a newscaster saying a lion has escaped from the zoo tonight. It's like, oh, so two of the three things have come true. And then this one guy says, well, at least no one said the pterodactyls are in the room. And then they all turn to look at him like, you idiot. And then he's like, oh my God,
Yes.
I just said it. I'm the guy. That's what you, oh no. So it's this sort of causality loop where because he told them it would
Well,
happen, they ended up saying it. But that's, it was a great, well, whatever. What'll really bake you,
right. Okay, so back to the idea of double indemnity. So in 2006, what percentage of deaths in the US were declared accidental? What would you say?
I go 28%.
Okay, well, the answer is actually 5%. Okay,
Five.
5% in 2006. I wasn't able to get
What?
information for something more recent. And basically, it says here for this reason, double indemnity clauses are usually relatively inexpensive and often aggressively marketed, especially to people over 45, people who have dangerous jobs, such as people who are in heavy construction, and also children are never generally eligible for multiple indemnity coverage.
Yeah, no doubt. I'm an Alaskan crab fisherman, and I would like to get double indemnity coverage. Sir, you are denied.
Yes.
Sir, you are
I
denied.
don't think so. So yeah, so
Yeah.
that's what we got about Houdini. So Neil looks over at Dell after he says this with a pretty unsympathetic and unwavering look. He's still pretty pissed off at him. Okay. And we see that Neil is holding the steering wheel with the tips of his fingers because we see the smoke still rising from numerous parts of the car, including the steering wheel. So it must still be very, very hot. And then we see Neil disengage his fingers from the steering wheel where they were actually stuck. And we hear the actual popping sounds of him pulling his fingers off of it.
The ripping of flesh, like he's crazy glued his hands to the steering wheel. He does little light rips as he takes a fingertip by fingertip off
Exactly.
the steering. It's such a great
And
piece of
then,
work because I imagine it's entirely
yeah.
mime, but it's with the sound effects, it's very
Yeah, and then he
believable.
opens the door very carefully because apparently the door is also steaming hot at this point.
Yeah, hissing, and like he's handling a hot potato, he's getting
Exactly.
all that
Yeah.
tss, ah, ooh, ah, ee,
And we see
ah,
even
you
when he
know, he's
closes the door, he's doing the same thing. And then Dell,
got to get some fabric over his
yeah.
hand. It's
And then
classic.
Dell, who always looks on the bright side of everything, says, "Well, one good thing about it, with all this fresh air, we're gonna sleep like babies." Now,
Now, I think this might be the most amazing bright side take I've ever heard
yeah,
in my life.
completely.
There. They're in a convertible in winter in Illinois. I mean, a quote-unquote
Yeah.
convertible. They have no
Well, it is a
roof.
convertible.
A
The
knock. It
yes,
is, yeah.
the town and country and the farming country are both convertible. So yes, they just found a new way to open the top.
But yeah, his take on
Yes.
this is
Now,
amazing.
his phrase, what he says here really startled me because I'm like, what does that mean? Fresh air, they're going to sleep better because of fresh air. So I actually did research and I found that that is true. Okay. I
Sure.
never knew that if you,
Go on a big old
that's right.
hike
You're
or
supposed to,
something, then
you know, that it lowers the risks of people developing allergies and contracting diseases. If you have more fresh air before you go to sleep, it will increase your oxygenation levels and overall sleep quality, right? And it also helps you wake up less during the night. So, you know, people are supposed, you know, according to this article that I read, it makes sense for you to, you know, go take a little a walk around nature before you go to bed.
I remember, I would imagine anyway, whenever you hear of kids that were sickly, right? That they were, you know, whatever, had those, you know, turn of the century diseases, like, you know, 5-year-olds getting pleurisy or emphysema or whatever, they'd be shipped off to the country, to their aunt's cottage by the seaside, just so they could get some fresh air and be out of the
The
industrial
same place
center or the big city or whatever.
where they used to send the dogs, you know, when they were getting old. You know, we send them to Aunt Bessie's
That's
farm.
right.
There
A
you
beautiful
go.
farm.
So we're gonna send
Beautiful farm.
little Johnny to that farm, and he'll be able to go spend time with the dogs.
That's right.
And so, yeah, I thought that's great because I never even noticed that he mentions this beforehand. And Neil just doesn't even pay him any attention and keeps walking. You know, doesn't even care.
Yeah, Neil's got the 1,000-yard stare at this point. He's like, I don't care. I don't care.
Exactly. He
Tell
has
me
no
anything,
patience
I
for
don't
Dell at
care.
this point. You know, and then
No.
we get a shot of the seats of the car, which you can see are completely melted, and there's like. And
Just
smoldering, you know,
skeletons.
we have like all this steam coming off of it or smoke or whatever. Yes.
Not comfortable. You know, I think this must be the chemical they put on pizzas in commercials to make them steam. It's very toxic, but it looks really authentic. I know that when you're doing a commercial for pizza, you gotta open up the pizza and there's steam coming off it, and the family's like, ooh, and then they go in to take a bite, then they're like, cut, and they gotta throw that pizza out because they've doused it in this really poisonous chemical, but it gives off a beautiful fake steam that looks exactly like a nice hot steam rising. So they must have just coated these metal skeleton chairs in that
Wow.
chemical to make
All
them steam for this
right.
shot.
So then we get an internal shot of the motel office. And the thing that the first thing that jumped out at me is that they're in the sign, they have a sign. You know, we see from the view of the clerk, there's a sign that says certificate of a superior motel. Okay. Now, what I found really funny is that's facing inwards and not
Okay.
outwards. You know, it's not something that anyone who's going to come is going to be able to see. It's for, you know, the clerk to reassure himself, I guess.
It's something for the clerk to remember.
Yeah. Now I did look and it does say on it the El Rancho. So they got that. It's nice that they added that in there. You know, we had that little the real detail that when they printed this out, they added the name of the El Rancho on there.
Nice.
And we see a few little items on the counter. We see a pen with a chain. We see a knuckle buster, which we talked about a few weeks ago. You know, the credit card machine. There's also a rotary phone there. So the pen with a chain, I decided to check that up a little bit. You know, I've seen it so many times, but I was just wondering when it originated, right? So it's actually called a counter pen. Okay. It's a pen that was designed to be affixed to the counter or table of an institution such as a bank or a post office,
That's right.
typically by chain, ball chain, or plastic cord, making it less likely that the pen will be accidentally or purposefully removed. Okay, in a 1938 issue of the Banker's Monthly, Okay, they described the concept, and they said the pen also gives a better write than the ordinary counter pen. The ink stand cannot be stolen, for it is fastened to the counter or desks. Besides, a chain between pen and stand prevents anyone from wandering away with the pen.
I
So,
remember, I would imagine inkstand is just an apocryphal name,
it
because
could be.
I did not see chains and pens. I've never seen a chain and a pen used with an actual old school inkwell pen,
Right.
right? I've only ever
Or
seen
feather.
this
Or feather.
or a quill,
A
or a quill
quill.
for the in an ink pot chained to the ink pot, which is in turn fastened to the counter. Although maybe it did used to be like that, because you've needed to use pens and banks since time immemorial. So maybe they did
It
have
could be.
literal ink pots or ink wells at some point.
Yeah. And then we get a shot of the clerk. Now, I'm
I do have a
assuming you
pen
did.
story. Do you want a pen
Oh,
story?
sure, why not?
There's when oh geez, in A Few Good Men.
Yes.
Kevin Pollak.
Ah, okay.
It's Kevin Pollak's first film. He's there with Tom Cruise, and he sees Tom Cruise making notes in his script. And Tom Cruise is writing with a hilariously huge pen, a massive, massive pen. And so he's like, wanting to ingratiate himself, so he's ribbing Tom Cruise about it, and like, hey, couldn't you get the large pen? Like all this kind of stuff. And then Tom Cruise says, "Well, actually, this is an amazing pen. This is a very limited edition, expensive pen, and it's $500. So it's a $500 pen." And Kevin Pollak's like, "That's ridiculous. That's ridiculous." And Tom Cruise is like, "Write with it. Here, write with it." And so Kevin Pollak takes the pen, and he has almost like a spiritual experience when he's like writing with this pen. That the flow of it, this the smooth motion of it, the weight of it in his hand, he's like, this is the most amazing writing experience I've ever had in my life. And Tom Cruise is like, see, I told you. And he was just using it to make notes in his script. So he said, hey, I take it all back. That's an amazing pen. That's incredible. And so that night, there's a knock on his dressing room door. And this orderly comes in and says, this is from Tom Cruise, and gives it to Kevin Pollak. And he opens it up, and it's one of those pens. And they make these pens in like one place in Paris, right? Like, this is an amazing, pen. And so he's like, oh my gosh, thank you so much. Says to Tom Cruise the next day, thank you so much. And the day after that, a couple of days go by, and Tom Cruise comes up to him and says, so, I mean, I bought you this pen, but I don't see you using it. And he's like, I can't use the pen. That's a $500 pen. I'm going to put this on a mantle, on my mantelpiece. And when people ask me, why is there a weird pen on your mantelpiece, I could tell them this solid gold story of how I got it from Tom Cruise. Well, I can't use it, especially just to like make notes in my script on set. That's something that I use a 5 cent Bic for. I would never do that with it. And no way, I can't. That's way too expensive. That's not something I'm used to just using in such a casual way. And
Wow.
Tom Cruise was like hurt. He was like, oh, well, okay. Okay. And then that night, there's another knock on Kevin Pollak's door, and there's a different PA there, and he's saying, this is from Tom Cruise. Tom Cruise has given him another copy of the $500 pen. So he's like, okay, you can keep that one for show, but use this one on set to make notes in your script.
Well, I
So he
guess
got
it's
like
nice to have money.
two pens for $1,000 as a gift from Tom Cruise, and they're like the best pens in the world. Anyway, nice to have money, sure.
Right, that's a very interesting story. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So then we get a shot of the clerk, and we get to finally see who the clerk is. The clerk is played by
Yay!
Martin Ferrero.
Martin
Okay,
Ferrero.
born in 1947, he has 30 TV credits, including 23 episodes of Miami Vice. Now, I've seen episodes of Miami Vice, but I don't recall seeing him on there.
What? 23? He must have been an informant or something, or some colorful street character that they talk to you now and again. 23 episodes? Huh. Well, there you go.
And but I mean, I know him from his movie work. So he has only 17 movie credits. All right. One of them obviously being this movie. And he's also in Get Shorty, Gods and Monsters. He plays George Cukor in Gods and Monsters. And his most famous role is in Jurassic Park. That's right.
The blood-sucking lawyer.
Yeah, so... Right, so back to what we were saying. In Miami Vice, he played two different characters. He played a guy named Izzy Marino and Trini DeSoto. Those are the two characters that he played.
Izzy Marino and Trini DeSoto. Of course Izzy, he played Izzy, a character called Izzy. Izzy Marini. Oh, my gosh.
Izzy.
Oh, Izzy. Sorry. Okay. That's like in Blow when Pee Wee Herman played that character called Derek For Real. I was like, oh. Oh, just gold. I love a good nickname of a CD character.
So he played Trini DeSoto in one episode, and then played Izzy Marino in the 22 other episodes. So yeah,
known for his wild ad libs and humor injected rants, he became a stalwart on the show of Miami Vice.
Could be.
I love this guy. I love this guy. He's so much. I always get him mixed up with John Cazale.
Ah, okay. I can see that. Yeah,
you know, Godfather. I'm smart, not like people said. You know, that astounding career of John Cazale, who starred in four movies that were all nominated for Best Picture.
Yes.
And he was married to Meryl Streep, and then he died. I'm like, dude, holy moly! Talk about hitting it and quitting it. It's all killer, no filler, and then you just checked out. Amazing.
Yeah.
So he looks similar to Martin Ferrero here.
Yes, that's true. So basically then Neil says to him, I need one room. And then Del goes, look, if you're pissed at me, maybe we should get separate rooms. And then Neil turns to him and goes, you get your own room.
Yeah, like, yeah, make no mistake.
I've had enough of you. Separate rooms. You get your own room at this point.
Do not be assuming that we're getting one room together.
That's right. And then the clerk says, I need a major credit card. And Neil goes, all right. And then he takes out his wallet and starts taking out steaming pieces of plastic. And he goes, oh, I have a Diners and I have a Visa
and still a smoking gasoline card.
Now, obviously, this is all completely impossible because – first of all, his wallet is not singed. Okay. And how did he put these cards in the wallet and close the wallet? You know, if they're that steaming hot and stuff like that. I mean, it works. The comedy works here. There's no question about that.
Comedy works great. Blackened, shrunken charcoal version of these credit cards. Yeah.
And then the clerk just looks at it and. You know, first of all, I love the fact that he's in his robe and pajamas. You know, it's like.
Which I've had that experience. I went to Spokane to stay at a motel with my dad and my brother, and the guy that answered the desk. And I remember it being like 9 a.m. or something. It wasn't like 6 a.m, but he came out in his bathrobe and his hair was just wild. He had obviously just come out of bed to answer the front desk. And I just remember that, like, what kind of hotel is this? Jeez.
And then he says to Neil, well, these aren't credit cards.
I love his creeping smile here, like he's on candid camera. Like he's stating the obvious to the clearly insane person. Like, we're all friends here. Like, these aren't credit cards. Yeah. You know, it's so good. Oh, and what's the gasoline card?
Yeah.
Oil Co.
Yeah.
Did you look that up? Is that a fictional card?
It's a fictional card.
Yeah, I would imagine. Completely. Okay.
Then Neil says, all right, I'll pay cash. And that's the way this minute actually ends. Now, I mean, we'll get into this a little more tomorrow, but how does he have cash? You know, I would assume that his cash would have been in his wallet and would have also been burned up.
Was it a sock?
It what?
An emergency backup $50 in each slot.
Well, we'll see tomorrow how much money he actually has.
He's got, how much he has left of the emergency backup sock money that he has.
That is true.
No, you're right. I don't know how the cash could possibly have survived if he's, maybe he just had some loose bills in his pocket. On his person.
Well, apparently that is the simple explanation.
Houdini dying like that, though, I think is pretty cheap. That reminds me of like the Steve Irwin getting killed by the stingray. You know, like you're like, what? No. Really? No. You want it to be like a big finish for somebody who's got a career like that. So you want, Houdini to die while jumping from the Empire State Building, trying to get out of a straitjacket or something. Just getting punched in the stomach seems really
Sure.
too bad.
Right, so the discrepancies in the script, there's a few here. So one of them is first of all, I love the description of Neil. It says Neil walks into the motel. He looks like an Alaskan bag person.
What? Okay.
And then most of the conversation goes the same way here. And there's the difference again between American Express and Diners. Shouldn't really make a difference. And then he
Right.
in the script he actually has three credit cards and doesn't have a gasoline card. He has American Express, MasterCard, and Visa. And those are basically the same things. And then Neil, after the clerk says those aren't credit cards, he goes, "They were. We had a small fire in the car and they melted." I'm sorry. I'll pay cash. So again, they're small little discrepancies, but they say a lot. And I've said this numerous times, but I love the editing of this movie because they're able to cut out parts of sentences and things still make sense.
Yeah, when I had heard that they had cut like 90 minutes out of the original film, and I was like, it still makes any kind of sense. Like, I know there's still some discrepancies with some lines that the
And
wife
the
says
beer
or something, or the
and
way she
the thing with the
reacts to it.
beer and there's a few things,
Yeah, so
but they did a very good job of the way that they cut it.
yeah, by and large, yeah, it's all very, very, it's all very legible and it still makes a lot of sense, which is a
For sure.
testament to
No
the
question
editor
about
for
that.
sure.
So every Wednesday we do a top five called Hughes Hump Day, where my guest will give their top
Nice.
five John Hughes movies. So once again, starting from number five and work your
Wonderful.
way up.
Number five is She's Having a Baby with good old Kevin Bacon there. That's a wonderful, wonderful film with a really excellent use of the Kate Bush song, This Woman's Work, when he's rushing to the delivery room at the climax of the film. It's a fantastic film. Number four would be another John Candy favorite, Uncle Buck, the classic Uncle Buck. I could it's not a well, it's sort of like an axe. The hatchet is sort of like an axe. I could circumcise a gnat with this person, with this instrument here. Wait, well, you're not a gnat, are you, Bug? Oh, wait a second, Bug, gnat. I'm seeing a similarity there, aren't you? Fantastic. Great lines too, like when the older sister says, "We need men so they can grow up, get married, and turn into shadows." Great line, great line. And I also love the interchange
You got a
between
lot of
him and
nose
Macaulay
hairs.
Culkin when they're asking each other like 50 questions or whatever. It's just classic, 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 classic film. And then Roseanne's sister from the TV show Roseanne, she's like the neighbor, the sassy neighbor. Good bits. Number three, Weird Science, which has not aged well, but which was one of my favorite movies at the time when it came out. And there's a great moment in it where they're leaving their Wyatt's parents' bedroom, I think, and they're wearing adult clothes because they're supposed to go to the bar with the woman they've created, and she's given them fake ID to make them both 21. And they come out wearing like their parents' outdated clothes, and then she twitches her nose and gives them cool 80s clothes. And there's this weird thing where I remember when I watched it for the first time, they came out in dorky clothes and got changed into wearing really super cool clothes for 1985 or 86 or whatever. But now when I watched it, I'm like, they come out looking amazing, wearing this really cool vintage suits. And then they get turned into these weird, blocky, dated 80s garbage suits. It's like, oh, it's so weird. That scene changed incredibly over time. But there's a bunch of scenes that didn't age well. Yeah, and maybe conceptually it it didn't age well at the time anyway, but it's all down to Kelly LeBrock. She saves the film from being completely you know, misogynistic nonsense or whatever. And then and of course the amazing Bill Paxton. For Christ's sakes, will you cover yourself? Yeah, it's so good. It's so good. All right, so number two, Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Still a timeless classic, still some really good advice in there, still a really good, really touching, beautiful movie. And I remember when I saw it when I was 16, I liked it because the teens weren't like movie teens. Like a lot of the teens that I had seen in movies like were like Porky's or something where they were just, you know, I don't know, horny shenanigans ensuing, or they were just, you know, it's like when you see kids in movies, you know, and they talk like they are speaking lines that were written for them by an adult. They're not children. They're weird, like virtual reality constructs. They're not actually children. So when you see a kid in a movie that's actually acting like a child, you're like, wow, this is really cool. They managed to capture something true here. And it was the same with the teens in Ferris Bueller's Day Off, where I was like, they're like having adult emotions. They're going through things and they're considering big questions. And when they have their day off, you know, they're not trying to sneak into a sorority and look at boobies. They go to the museum. They go to the art museum. You know, they have lunch at a nice restaurant. They do things that are just like, finally, teens are doing, you know, kind of human, cool things of like depth and layer and character. So I like that. And then, of course, number one would be Breakfast Club for a lot of the same reasons, where there's these nuanced, deep performances that are given in the five archetypes that are presented there. And I just love John Hughes's way of show, don't tell. Like when all the kids are getting dropped off, you know, like the way they interact with the parents. Bender just walks right in front of a car.
She doesn't
has
need
to like stop suddenly. You know, and they're all just, and I love that Ally Sheedy's character doesn't say anything for like the first third of the movie, right? And then, Molly Ringwald says, "Yeah, my parents, you know, they use me to get back and to hurt each other. I think I'm just a pawn in their game." And then from the back of the room, you hear Ally Sheedy go, "Ha!" And everybody turns like, oh, like the chair just talked or something. They're like, what? I forgot you were here. Like, what? That's just amazing. I don't really care for the fate of her character in that movie and the bit where they like all smoke weed and it's this great equalizer. Not really my bag either, but there's so many parts of the movie that really work. And as far as I've been able to tell, some of the high school teachers that I know, they say that the film still resonates, even with its lack of cell phones or whatever, and its datedness, that still teens can watch it today and go, oh man, awesome, super true, very funny, or whatever. So that's good to hear.
Wow. All right. Excellent. So every day we have a segment called Off the Beaten Track, where either myself or my guest will give a little story about an adventure or misadventure that one of us might have had over the course of life. So you got another one for a second?
I do indeed. And this is a very John Hughes moment, which I could actually hear the down, down, happening in my head. I'd done a thing down here called the Symphony Under the Crane. There's this giant crane on a small part of Vancouver called Granville Island, where there's a lot of tourist shops and a giant open air market. It's a real place for a lot of people to go, but there's also a small community of houseboats that are all tied to the pier there. So there's these people that have been living in houseboats there, like two or three story houseboats, not just like, I mean, these are like floating houses, really. And so they have this Symphony Under the Crane. There's this giant construction crane that's still there that I don't think is actually used anymore, but it's still there. So one summer night, they had the Vancouver Symphony underneath the crane, and they had all these tables set up in the open air to do an open air orchestra concert for the people. And I was hired to be security for the houseboats. I just had to walk around the houseboats and make sure that nobody was sneaking off to break into one of the houseboats or something like that. So I'm wearing a white shirt and black pants because I have to look professional. So the concert ends and I'm walking back and there's a few tips on the tables and there's no wait staff. They're long gone. So I was like, okay, yoink. Had to give me like $5 or something off of that. But I'm walking, there's a couple of fancy restaurants down there for the rich tourists. So I'm walking by this one fancy restaurant, and this guy gets out of his brand new candy apple red 911 Porsche with his, you know, wife, who's like 20 years younger than him, his hot trophy wife. And he looks at me and he goes, "Hey," he gives me a little whistle, and then throws me the keys to his Porsche and walks into the restaurant.
Hey, $5 on a Porsche. Why not?
Right. He assumed I was a valet because I had a white shirt and black pants, and he assumed this place had valet parking. And I wish I could say that there was some legendary conclusion, but I didn't have my license. I didn't know anything, how to drive a car, let alone a standard. So I just chased him down and said, "Hey, buddy, I'm not LA. I don't think this place has valet cars parking. Here's your keys back." And he went white. He was just like when he realized that I could have just hopped in the car and had a fun little joyride adventure with his Porsche.
Oh, come on, it's Canada. You know this not going to happen.
Yeah, I suppose not.
All right. Excellent. Thank you. Great story. All right. You want to once again tell people how they can get in touch with you?
Chronologically speaking, look up Duncan Shields on YouTube. Go buy Small Windows, my book, and just take a look for Buy Duncan Shields on Instagram and Twitter, and I'll talk to you there.
All right. And finding me is very simple also. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook, on Twitter, or go to our website. So until tomorrow, you're fine.
You're fine.